the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.
People, Leo Phillips here with This Must Be The Gig, your backstage pass to the world of live music. Every single week, we bring you fascinating conversations from the beating heart of the performance scene with some of the most exciting names on this gigantic, big, spongy globe. We talk passion, we talk first concerts, last concerts, and everything in the juicy center. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Scott Avett of the Avett Brothers. We chat about the life-changing power of seeing Tom T. Hall sing Mr. Bojangles, playing with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson, and the surprising influence of Faith No More's Mike Patton. But before we dig into all of that, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios. Hello, Engineer Adam.
Hi. Hi. Hey, hi. How's it going?
I'm good. It's been a week. It's been a week. What has been going on?
Just ramping up here to episode 75.
I can't believe it's episode 75.
I know. It's great. It's like, it feels like a big round accomplishment.
This last month, I feel I was just going through it in my head. I feel like we've gone to many, many shows in Chicago
we
are both proud of. So speaking of Scott playing with Bob Dylan, we just saw Bob Dylan at the UIC.
Yeah, it's the Center. Credit One Arena, I believe, is what the new name of it is. But I know it is the UIC Pavilion.
The thing I loved most about Bob Dylan's performance the sparkly pants that he was wearing. And also how seamlessly he went from piano to harmonica to guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
And also how after every single song, the lights dimmed.
Yes, it was very
pro.
You
don't get that anymore.
It was very classy, old school pro move.
What do you think he did in those milliseconds when the lights were dimmed?
I think he danced a jig every time.
A jig?
Yeah.
We had the beautiful trifecta in the last month and a bit of Joanna Newsom into
Nick Cave
and the conversations which you chatted about on a previous episode, and into
Jonesy
with Alex Summers playing, and the Wordless Orchestra playing Rice Boy Sleeps.
Oh boy, that was a good one.
Insane. What a crazy month. And we also got to see the Lighthouse, which if anyone is obsessed with the orifices of fish, You can see that.
I'm sure at least one listener is obsessed with the orifices of fish.
The orifices. Yeah,
absolutely.
So let's dig into our favorite feature here at TMDGWWW Studios.
And that is the live show of the week.
Oh my God. We lose steam on that one.
No.
We never lose.
Live show of the week.
There you go.
Each week we highlight the most heart-thumping event that we could find out there, and we share it with our listeners so that they can all head to the show themselves.
Mm-hmm. So for this week's live show of the week, we are looking at a performance from the Jenny Slate, who has an amazing stand-up special on Netflix right now, and that is at the Vic Theatre in Chicago on Friday, November 8th, one week after November 1st, which, if anyone has been listening, was my birthday.
We here at the show love Jenny Slate.
You're not going to even acknowledge that.
I was about
so
to.
So sad.
I was about to. We love Jenny Slate. And her coming to Chicago a week after your birthday is the greatest
birthday present that could ever be had.
We loved her stand-up special, as Lior mentioned, on Netflix, Stage Fright. It's a must-watch. I highly recommend everybody go out there and listen. And also, the perfect way to get tickets to her little mini stand-up tour or to any other stand-up show or any concert or gig
sporting event of your choosing. We just bought loads of Bulls tickets on StubHub, our favorite go-to
That is
hub.
Very true. It is quite the hub.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to get tickets to anything, StubHub via cosradio.lv/StubHub. That's cosradio.lv/StubHub. To find the best selection of tickets to the hottest shows, one more time, that's cosradio.lv/StubHub.
So after you've listened to this incredibly expressive, in-the-moment, all-encompassing conversation that we have on this week's episode, go to cosradio.lv/StubHub. But let us focus now on the interview with Scott. He calls in fresh off the release of the Avett Brothers' new album, Closer Than Together. In addition to discussing the dual influence of Mike Patton and Bob Dylan, Scott and I also chat about the complexity of playing music and touring with family. We also talk about the courage it takes to admit you're having an off day in general, and then also admit you're having an off day on stage and just pushing through with a performance anyway. So this is me and Scott. Enjoy!
I think our longest break in 19 years has been 3 months.
Oh my gosh.
You know, we'll take a week off or sometimes as much as in the holiday season, like a month or a month and a half. But it's been a way of life for us. It's a living of ours that we have learned how to cultivate and we enjoy. And it's our language, you know.
Is touring something for you that it was, you know, like riding a bike? Like once you got used to it, it was natural. It was kind of the, you know, it spoke to the core of who you are. You naturally, you know, molded into this way of life. Or is it kind of something still that you feel a little bit distant from?
No, it's when I was a little kid, my father traveled to work. He worked on bridges. He was a welder, and we would either occasionally travel with him, or when we did take trips and I saw truck drivers, to me they were like the rock stars of the world, you know. I thought, how romantic, how incredible to be in that cockpit and just hit the open road. And so through that, you know, I think that upbringing, just hitting the open road or hitting the road, just it was something that we did anyway. And we found a reason to do that along with what we love doing as far as writing songs and performing. So I think it's as important as it was to become, like, to learn how to play an instrument. It's just as important, has been just important, to learn how to travel and learn how to how to move and live with other people.
Yeah, I love that you said that, because I feel like a lot of people just focus on the writing portion of it, the magic happening, the recording. Also, 20 years ago, whilst touring was absolutely crucial, I don't think it's ever been more crucial as it is now. because it's your main form of income. It's your main way to guarantee that you're getting right in front of your fans.
So it always was for us, and it always was. We never saw it another way. So it served us very well to not see instant success early. That was very good to us because we got very practiced in traveling.
But tell me about the first times then, when you first started getting on the road. What were the things that really shocked you out of the whole ideal of it? Because obviously, you know, going into it as a recording artist versus a touring musician, and then when you finally get on the road, what were some of the surprising elements of touring that you never expected?
More in hindsight, when I look at how, as I have worked to improve. The shape that I'm in when I'm traveling, to travel in a more effective way, it's surprising how, this is later, this wasn't something that I found surprising instantly because I was overlooking it, but it's surprising to me how neglectful I was to my own well-being, physically and mentally. I would just, you know, you would just wonder, why in the world am I angry? Why am I not performing well? Why is my voice blowing out? Like, those things were a mystery. When I look back now, I go, they were no mystery. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I was drinking, ridiculous amounts. And it was such an eye opener to stay in it long enough to adjust some of that and go, well, wait. If you are going to do this, you know, like Pearl Jam or like Bruce Springsteen, like, you're going to do this for a long time, you have to grow up a little bit in it. And it's surprising how little we paid attention to that early on and could still operate and made it through. It's surprising we didn't ruin it all, you know.
There's so many artists that I've spoken to over, you know, the last decade even, who look back at their lives and think, I was right on the edge and on the cusp of, you know, wrecking my voice. Or, you know, there's so many artists who you have those, like, horror stories. Like, I remember chatting to Shirley Manson of Garbage, and she, like, had some terrible thing happen whilst she was on stage to her voice. So it was, like, halfway through, which is, of course, you know, it's like a ballet dancer breaking their ankle. Or, you know, it's equivalent. That performative aspect is so important to your lives. And if you don't take care of your body... Mm-hmm. But again, this is something that they don't tell you before you start.
No. You still have to learn it. Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty obvious. And I think in any group that is just playing night after night in a bar or a club, you take it far enough. And if you make it through that, it's either going to end you or you're going to learn from it one way or the other. I mean, right? Like, there's going to do one or the other. You don't just sort of keep doing it. I guess, unless maybe you're the Rolling Stones, which everybody says it's just gone on forever. But for us,
absolutely.
I had to change. Like, there was a moment when I said, okay, no more alcohol on the road, period. Like, that was what I had to do, or I was going to self-destruct for sure.
Do you feel like once you were cognizant of that shift and that change and being more self-aware on the road, especially with your body, with your mental health, do you feel like that allowed you to use your writing in a different way? Because sometimes we turn to certain mediums like art or poetry or movies or TV, you know, what have you, whatever fills our need. We turn to it in a time sometimes when we are feeling a little bit lost. But when you're at your best, sometimes it's a little bit, where do you draw your inspiration from? You know, so did you feel like it shifted your approach almost to your writing?
I'm certainly not a believer, and I'm not sure that you're suggesting this at all. I don't think you are, but I guess in the past I might have thought, well, if I'm struggling, the more I'm struggling, the better my art might be. And there is true, through some struggles, some really great things have happened and have come. But I'm not a believer that for one, I'm not a believer that things are just going to always be great and that I'm always going to be my best. Even when I'm hyper aware of it and awake to it, I still find myself depressed. That's part of life for me. Being awake to it is the point. And I've seen being awake to it and being aware of I guess, self-care, spiritual awakeness, presence, just presence, has actually made writing easier, less critical. It's certainly made being a rock star on stage much more acceptable and easy because it's not so critical anymore. It's like, right. Hey, this isn't so serious. Go. Not the end of the world. Go and enjoy it and own it. You know, take it, be it. And it's been beautiful for me. Like, I've been on stage and felt just out of my skin before because I felt like I didn't deserve it. You know, I wasn't worth it. And who knows, maybe I was just hungry.
Well, exactly. But also like fostering belief in oneself in any capacity, whether it's in a relationship or whether it's in, you know, the work that you do when you're younger, with your family, with your art. It's really something that does take, unfortunately, it takes time because it's like getting comfy in, as you mentioned, getting comfy in this like new skin. You know, when you're getting up on stage, you're adopting this, not persona, because it's very much you guys, but you are still putting forth this version of yourself, you know? And that requires so much belief, which again, as you mentioned, it's not like you are your best, you write the best stuff when you're at your lowest, but you just have to function basically. And I quite like what you said about being like just having that presence. That's so fascinating because a lot of people don't really, you know, they don't look at it like that. You know, there's this whole like horrible idea of the tortured artist, I guess, you know. I learned that when I started writing all of those years ago. I even said, I need to hold myself up. No one must talk to me. I need to be in the darkness with my headphones. And that doesn't really work sometimes because you really do need to have all those elements intact to have that belief in yourself in order to perform.
That's true. And the darkness is going to come no matter what. Like, you know, you don't have to impose it on yourself. That's for sure.
Right. So when you're touring and especially the beginning of your careers, do you remember the first live music that you saw that wasn't, I suppose, because I know that both your grandmother and father were musicians, but what was the first live show that you saw that wasn't one of your family members?
Yeah, I think it was, I think that the very first live show I saw with like a musical show was Tom T. Hall, the country singer and songwriter. And it was at a place called the Stanley County Agricultural Center. It was a little theater, probably, I bet it was 300 people. And I remember he did Mr. Bojangles. He put a little jacket on for the song. But Tom T is a big, it's so good. It's so good. And he did a little dance with it, like a little two-step, like a real graceful little two-step. Now, Tom T is probably 86 or 87 now, but he's been a great inspiration. But I was thinking about this before this podcast, and I always go to my first concert, but that was more of this live performance. So, and I bet I was, I guess I was 8 and I might have gone something before then, but I don't recall it.
Right. And especially with that Mr. Bojangles song, when you have that visual of like putting the jacket on, it's so, there's again that performance artist version of a singer songwriter. And you like fill it with like even listening to that song, which I used to listen to nonstop when I was younger. I have no idea why. I think it was just something that, I don't know, it was just something that was in the performance scene, like in drama and dancing. They always used to use that as a reference because there's so many layers to that song. especially with the repetition in some of the lyrics and and like it's such a great song. So had you heard him before you went to the concert?
So he has these children's songs. He made children's songs and children's album and songs like Sneaky Snake and some songs that weren't children's songs but sounded like them, like I Love and I Care. Those are two songs that were so they were played often in our house, and we were really close to him. And it was easy to be close to him as a kid because he was really capable. He is very capable of speaking to children in a very beautiful and simple way. And he had told, I met him later on in life in Franklin or in outside of Nashville, Tennessee, at his house. And, you know, that we talked a little bit about how few words can you say what you need to say in. That resonated with me for a long time. And I think that's what speaks to kids, you know, saying big, prolific things in little sentences and little words. That's beautiful.
And especially being able to do that and being so convincing as well, because there's a level of simplicity,
no doubt,
especially with kids and even children's books. There's that level of simplicity that a lot of authors get right when they pair it with a visual component. But when you could just use a word, which I feel like you've kind of done on your new record with Tell the Truth. There's so many layers on that song.
Yeah.
There's so much ideology behind it, like, you know, self-honesty and self-love and all of that kind of stuff. And I feel you say it and it isn't it's not simplistic as in elementary. It's just really focusing in on an idea and not, you know, complicating it, which I think is rare.
That's a perfect example because that's a universal truth.
Right.
And that the whole point is, can you start? Where do you start? Like, where the heck do you start if you're just trying to I don't know, just to wake up? Where do you start? And I convince myself of so many non-truths that that's the song, you know, that's the idea. And I intentionally wanted that song to have as few words as possible and have them repetitive. And totally. That's the perfect example.
I mean, I also feel like there is that universal idea that universal truths are poppy, you know, because they appeal to a lot of people.
Yep.
And I feel like that kind of devalues the aspect of the fact that we all get it, no matter where we're from. You know, I grew up in freaking South Africa. I shouldn't understand country music. I didn't grow up with it. But, you know, what you're singing about is so important because, again, that's far surpasses, like music, like art, it far surpasses the idea of, you know, we are all different. Instead, it kind of brings us together and connects us, which I think that song does. And there's a really nice hope to it as well. And I saw you perform it on Fallon, which was amazing because that's something, that's something that I can imagine with a challenging song like that. And then on live TV, that's also quite, I can imagine that whole aspect of it and the logistics are quite difficult, just mentally and emotionally getting yourself into that zone.
Yes, but there's a real natural belonging, I think, with that song. Like that was very much in my range, very much like a true aspiration. And so without having to pretend or strain to get to a certain range, there's such a nice belonging in that song for me. And I think for our group, you know, I think we just, it's in our wheelhouse, it's in our voice and it's in our language. So we performed it enough leading up that, and back to what you were talking about on stage, there is a belonging now that I don't think I had to earn, but I had to live life to recognize. I think it's always been there, but it's just, when do you wake up to it? That gives such a calm in my core when I go on stage to know that I belong. And even if I'm going to mess up the whole night, even if I'm going to have a terrible night, every night won't be my night. It's okay. And so then I end up having more nights, I think.
Well, also when a song like has more lives than just the song itself, I guess when you are creating this thing that can be interpreted in so many different ways, you know, it's all about like, how does somebody relate to it? And then having that calmness and knowing that it isn't only about how you're performing it, it's also about how people are perceiving it as well, which I think is... again, something so fascinating about artists who like keep their shit together, you know, when they are, I've spoken to people who've written songs about their, you know, how they are widowed now, about how they were sitting in the hospital beds with, you know, their grandmothers or children holding their hands, watching them pass. You know, there's so many things like that, that you feel... fans sometimes disconnect, of course, as you're a fan as well of music, and you disconnect. You don't know the background to every song you listen to.
No.
So I really like that word calm, because I think that mastering it's mastering of something within you, that you believe in the song, you believe in the audience, you believe in your band, and then being able to really speak through that, I think is kind of, that's the art there.
You that's know, everything. That's everything. It is. It is. It's not. I think so many times people, and I'm guilty of this probably, you start to veer off and go, well, how well can I do something?
Right.
How can I show people that I can do things well? And that's so, that can promote such an imbalance of what this is as a experience, as a relationship, which is what I've learned that shows, like, it's everything. It's just like you said, relationship is what shows are. They're not, it's not a showcase, it's not a revealing of how you are special and you do something great. That's, you know, you end up doing, you know, by default we tend to learn how to do things very well because we spend time with them,
right?
And that's great. That really, it really is beautiful, and we have to own that. However, without that relationship of all things, like you were just saying, it can become actually something very disgusting versus something completely, like, totally beautiful.
And it takes a long time. I mean, I'm not a musician by any measure, but as on the other side of it, to watch somebody again speak of things that they've truly believe in, you can feel that in, even if it isn't in your home language, which is feeling within the band and that cohesion as well, that I think, especially for Avett Brothers, you guys have really made sure that you come as this collaborative force, as opposed to this is my time, this is my way. And I feel like it's always been like, you know, and I think that that's also kind of an old school way of doing things. It's giving everybody the accolades and giving everybody the understanding that you're in this together, which I as a listener, you do feel that, you know, or at least
that's
I
good.
Do. But talking about collaboration, because obviously, you know, you recently released the new album, and congratulations on that. I think it's such
thank
a wonderful
so
record. And you have such a long history of working in creative partnerships, you know, with the band and like Rick Rubin. Now, I don't know how many albums he's worked with you. Is this now the fourth? No, wait, what are we on now? This would be the fifth album, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Why do you think collaboration has been such an important part of your creative process?
Well, obviously, at the core, you know, it's brotherhood, which is just, you know, it's just collaboration. It's the fact that we're brothers is, it's not, I don't know if it's secondary, but in a way, it's a little secondary. We're partners. And I think at that core, we, I guess that's a limitation. It's a commitment to each other. In relationships, committing to someone is where we find wonderful love, deep love, deep understanding, even through our disagreements and the way we see things differently, but committing to each other. And so that commitment to other people is where we have found the fruits of life, I think. And we also do it, it's reflective in our correspondence and communication with other businesses. Like our corporation you know, I get it sometimes from some of my closest, some of my family members and friends will remind me, hey, you don't have to be so loyal to this handful of people that you work with. But it's so much not about, it's not about the tribe that we have made. It's not about that at all. It's about digging in with each other. And I just believe that we'll make the best and find the best stuff of life through our commitments to each other. Really, if you think about it, if you have one person to work with, there's not even enough time in this life to wring that or that rag out, you know, like to get everything from it that we possibly could. We don't have enough time in a lifetime to experience another person. So to dig in with several, I just feel like we're like in a long-term relationship, on a long-term journey, where great things will happen because of our because the limitation slash commitment slash liberation with each other.
Yeah, and also because, you know, everybody will always constantly ask you about working with your brother and doing, you know, working with your partners and being in this long-term relationship. But what do you mean by limitation? Do you mean just because there's a restriction, as in like it's blood, you can't deviate, it's going to be with you, he's going to be with you forever?
But what I mean is, well, we have to represent this work together. So like we've learned, and this is so applicable to this record. This is something that has been coming up in our conversations on our bus and within interviews, et cetera. We disagree on many things, you know. Two people that love each other disagree on things. That's just how it goes.
Pause the podcast.
Pause the podcast.
Are you looking at a calendar full of great events but struggling to find tickets? StubHub's gotcha. Whatever your favorite band, team, or venue, StubHub is here to save the day with the best tickets for any budget.
Whether you're looking for a seat at a Broadway show, tickets to the summer's big arena tour, or a night of cheering on your hometown team, StubHub has the seats you're looking for at the price you want to pay.
Head to cosradio.lv/StubHub or their user-friendly app to find tickets that are 100% guaranteed by FanProtect. StubHub's never sold out, with the most shows, the most tickets, and the most fans.
So, head on over to cosradio.lv/StubHub, or the StubHub app. The best tickets to the best experiences in music, sports, and theater.
That's cosradio.lv/StubHub.
But how do we disagree? How do we move forward? How do we remain unified in disagreement? How do we love each other through our disagreement? But those disagreements certainly cause limitations. Like, if I'm going to present something to record or to perform on stage, Seth doesn't have to agree with it completely or doesn't have to necessarily understand it completely, but he at least has to say, hey, I'm going to stand on stage, or I'm behind it. You know, he at least has to be able to get behind it. And I would imagine that through our lives, we're not always going to be able to get behind everything each other does, but that's where the limitation lies. So me alone as an artist, who knows where I'll go if I didn't have to, refer to anybody else. You know, I'd go wherever I wanted and never consider anybody else. But in this partnership, there is a consideration. And if it's going to be something that person doesn't understand, I have to at least present it and say, hey, I'm thinking of this. I think this will be great. What do you think? Does that make sense as far as the limitation part?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I also think part of being creative, there's like creating kind of temporary spaces that can feel separate from the rest of the world, you know, so you're creating kind of this little positive world in this really negative surroundings. And I think having your family around you, a family I use as a, you know, really loose term as well, blood, and also people that you've worked with for so long, to challenge you,
yeah,
I think is a really important thing Because, like, look at our loved ones. Like, how hard are they on us? I mean, mine are constantly telling me, pushing me. Otherwise, they wouldn't be the ones that I loved. I don't think we pick people in order to just be our cheerleaders only. You know, you really do need to have some sort of conversation, especially creative conversations with your own brother. If you agreed, how would you stretch whatever imagination you have around your songs? Like, would you know if you're on the right path if someone's not going, you're an idiot, can we please talk about this? Or not to say that that's how they speak to you, but you know what I mean? Like, because you get a chance to kind of, there's like a rebuttal, you know, you get a chance to argue your point. And then in arguing, you believe in it more. And so I think that that's kind of great to hear that there is that relationship there that you're feeling challenged by. I think that's always important.
Absolutely. The best show, this past couple of weeks, there was a show in Cleveland we played, and it really stood out, right? Like, it really stood out as the show just felt like the relationship with all things just went deep. It just, you just felt it. And part of it for me individually was I was conflicted about something, and there was nothing I could do about it on stage except put that intensity into whatever I was doing and apply it to whatever I would like. If the expression was happiness, then apply this to it and let it be as big a happy or whatever, as big as whatever it was going to be, as vibrant. And the show, it lifted, it elevated. I felt it elevate because of that, individually anyway, in one of those conflicts, you know?
So what happened before that it turned out to just come together? Was there any like sign of doom in the beginning, or was it just one of those situations where everything just worked?
Something dawned on me, like something was revealed to me during the show about, like we were performing one of the newer songs, the song Bang Bang, and something dawned on me about it, about some of the word usage. And it wasn't anything against anyone else, but it was like, man, what do I do with this? You know, and it just really filled me up with fire and inspiration. Like, inspiration is not the right word, with the vigor that I just, sort of attacked the rest of the show with it.
Yeah.
But it just made the intensity feel deeper and stronger. And then once the initial sort of feeling, like the reactive feeling that I had, once it settled in and I knew reacting to it was not correct except through channeling it, once that settled in, then we were kind of on a ride that was like, now all cylinders are firing so beautifully. And the set list was a big part of it. The set list was one that had been thought out well. That's important. The story that we were telling that night through the songs that were coming out was, you know, sometimes it's hit or miss. And that night it was hitting very well.
So talk to me then about the tools that you're needing, like emotionally, I suppose, and also just logistically, because you now mentioned the set list. And I'm not going to ask, obviously, where the magic comes from in order to perform well, but what are the things that you need in place to make sure that the evening goes to plan, or at least to make sure that the performance that you're enjoying performing?
I personally think we have to know where we are. Not that we lean on that directly, like as far as logistically or geographically.
Right.
We don't necessarily talk about that, but I think just the presence of where you are. A lot of times one of my big tools is if I'm feeling off, then instead of resisting that, it's important for me to start the show off. Just be off. Like, if you know what I mean, like, then I'll find myself climb out of that through the show more likely than if I tried to force. And this was one of those surprises, I would say, early in touring, where I would say, okay, I'm feeling a little sluggish, so let's go out like swinging. Let's just open this thing up full energy. And I would find us crashing so early in a set through that. And Now I would say, okay, you're off. Don't move. Just sing the song and watch and listen. And what happens? You know, what will happen? And if you're meant to move, if you're meant to, if this is high energy, then it'll come. But if not, that's okay. Just let it be. And now I'm very much, it's changed a lot for me. I can do that now and say, no, this is one of my quote unquote off nights. And sometimes those end up being referred to as, you know, some fans will say that was the best show I saw from them.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder, like, oh, God, what am I even, what, you know, I have no idea. But I just try to be who I, like, one night might be full, you know, it might be high energy, it might be up, 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 and then the next time might be flat foot, down, 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 and it's okay. Just be in it and be it.
But always like feeling into humanness, which I like to kind of phrase it as. It's
totally.
Look at the relationships again. I always relate it back to like connections with humans. When you are high, like completely flying off the wall, nervous or insecure or feeling like you're somewhere else during a conversation or, you know, what have you, any business meeting, whatever, you're never going to tap into that ease and that calmness that you chatted about earlier. And it isn't about this like, oh, you're embracing being in the moment. It's more about just understanding that, you know, you're going to get that high through the performance, which I really like that idea. What you said is that even if you start off low, understanding that you are fueled by your own music and performing, so naturally you'll go up.
Sure.
I think people don't, but that's also a belief. It stems kind of to everything we've chatted about. A lot of people don't find that confidence, or they just don't believe that they'll, you know, it's like finding fuel through making art. You know, that's how you get back to yourself. Like if you're feeling shit, actually saying to an audience, I'm feeling a little low, is, for me, when I hear
no
that,
doubt.
Is actually so much better than me seeing this person struggling through the performance, like pushing, because you almost feel like tense watching that.
I'm with you. I mean, the same show every night, not just the same songs every night, but the same tempo and the same tone and the same mood and vibe from the person every night. I'm with you. I don't know I don't relate to that as well as if someone actually on stage was just to say, you know, I'm off, I feel a little down tonight, but here I am, and here we go. I'd be like, wow, okay, what?
Exactly.
It's great.
Know that, again, I feel like we're on the cusp of like 2020. Like, look, when we all found our music, artists were so far out of reach for us. You know, there were more costumes, there were more pseudonyms, there were more stage names. You know, there was less about the realness and a lot about that, the theatrics of it. But I definitely think that there's some value in really honing in on who you are in that moment, and that kind of puts everyone else into the place of like, oh, thank God I can, like, you know, unbutton the top button of my pants and, you know, like let it out.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Yep. Like you get getting comfy.
I totally do. I totally understand that.
So do you remember a show that you saw that really stuck out for you as a memory in terms of, I feel like I can do that?
Yeah. Can I give you a contrast of a moment that was,
Yes, of course.
Let me say, because it's important to me. These contrasts are so important to me. But there were, let's see. Well, no, it wasn't the same venue, but the same type of venue. There are two acts. This would have been between like, this would have been like 1998 or 7 and 2000, or 1998, 2000, where we grew up always, I know Tom T. Hall was country, and that's the first thing I saw. But after that, everything was like, my very first real concert was Van Halen. And then it was like Alice in Chains and Ozzy Osbourne and Helmet and Korn and Deftones and like this. Like that's what I was into. That was the world. And that was what the bands that I played in. That's what we played. I idolized Mike Patton from Faith No More.
Oh, wow.
And I would go see is that I would see him perform anytime he was anywhere near. And I saw Mr. Bungle in 2000 twice when the California record came out. And that was like, as I watched that, I didn't think I could do that, but I knew I was going to try to be that. I knew that I wanted to be my version of that. I wanted to be that version of myself, you know, like, I was not Mike Patton. I can't be Mike Patton because I'm not Mike Patton, but I knew that Mike Patton, he does such a good job of being his unique self, his original self. In good and bad, he's always followed. And it's been a brilliant guiding light for me. And something that happened to help sort of turn the light on myself. I also saw a group called the Blue Rags. Mm-hmm. And the Blue Rags were all North Carolina natives, I think. All five guys were superstars. I mean, they're all just like superstar musicians and entertainers. They didn't draw a big crowd, but they were on Sub Pop for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love that
they've
label.
All gone on. They all are oh, it's a great label.
Yeah.
And the Blue Rags, what they did, they were young men playing something like old-time country ragtime music. And when I saw it, it had all the same piss and vinegar that Mike Patton had. but it was like old-timey sounding ragtime music, and that blew my mind because the contrast of those types of shows and the fact that young men were doing it, it felt kind of like a coming home for me and a full circle thing where I was like, okay, I'm seeing something being articulated that I feel and I am part of. Now what, you know, now what do I do with it? And that was around the time that I was picking up the banjo out of irony. The only reason I wanted to play banjo was because the art, you know, I'm in art school and there's mostly punk rock kids and skater kids. And we all listened to hard rock, you know, hardcore and punk rock. But the banjo was so ironic to have. And then I took to it very naturally. So it was very fun to play for a crowd that really, you know, we would play house parties, you know, or sit together on Tuesday night and just jam. But it was not like, it wasn't bluegrass, but it was imitating some of it with sort of a, I don't know, a little bit of a wink and a nod and a, I don't
right.
know. It was still fiery and punk rocky, but, both Mr. Bungle and the Blue Rags were both these animated versions of something that I knew was part of my DNA. Like, and I was like, I'm gonna get in on this. I want to get like seeing the Blue Rags.
I'm gonna get some.
Like,
yeah.
I have this voice to be like, I'm gonna get in on this because I'm not gonna be a spectator to this for much longer. I need to get in with this and when I do, there's no stopping me. You know, that's how it felt.
Absolutely. I know. I actually had Mike on the show a few weeks ago, and chatting through mm-hmm. the concept of obviously the different iterations of the worlds that he's been a part of, and talking how
yeah.
he approaches that, and how the hell so much variety and vastness of space and of art can come from one human. It's an overwhelming
yep.
thing. And I love that. Yeah. I love that you connected to that.
100% mainline. I mean, from the time I was 15 years old, when I discovered him, I mainlined Mike Patton. And I use that same, you know, through my visual art and my music, I use that same energy and belief that, I mean, it's wide open. It's wide open, and there's no limit to, there's all those beautiful limitations we're talking about, but there's no limit to what we can make and want to get involved in. And making space to work, you know, it's just how we live. It's how I do life I feel it and I document it and I move with it. And I can imagine with Mike Patton, I think he, you know, sonically, you know, through audibles, like he's done such a good job of following through with so many different projects. And some of them you don't have to understand, you know, like I don't even have to like some of them, but I always appreciate them. I've always appreciated them.
Yeah, and I think that he knows that too. And that's the difference between an artist that caliber versus an artist who's kind of still feeling it out, is that I think he just does it and then turns around and says, okay. There's no, like, it's this fearlessness, but also stemming from this curiosity. And I think, like, trying new things, there is some sort of value to staying curious and open to new ideas, you know, in order to have a life of sustained creativity. Like, as you mentioned, you're a visual artist as well. I watched this amazing video, by the way, of you talking about your art, and you likened it to a ballad. I don't know if you remember that.
I hope
it was you.
Sounds good. I'm going to say it now.
But you said it because you were looking at artwork and saying that, like, with a ballad, you've got to, like, be really close to it. It's kind of intimate. And especially with art as well, you've also got to kind of go right up into it. And I feel like you can liken that to artists as well, like Mike Patton, like Ozzy, like all those artists who are just so wild that you almost feel like there is so much human about it that you can't. It's like, how do you, you have to get so close to it.
I think there'd be more people that revealed themselves as that wild if they were practicing to be their true selves, you know? Like, that's what I feel like Mike Patton, like, he's a good example. There's other examples, but a person that expresses truly who, you know, he's being truly who he is through great courage. If more people cozied up to that idea, you'd probably see more, you know, wild folks like that. I don't know what the world would do with that. You know, I don't even know if it's possible.
Yeah.
There's only so much space.
He's wild.
For Mike Patton, you know? Like,
absolutely. Do you have, like, a dream musician then that you want to perform with? At the Grammys, you performed with Mumford & Sons and Bob Dylan. Where does Bob Dylan then stand in the, like, pantheon of inspiration for you guys? Like, do you have a dream? Like, how was that performance? I think that's the first part of what I'm wondering. And then the second is, like, who else could top that? You know, who could be above that?
Well, I'm totally. And we've been so fortunate to perform. I mean, we've performed with Willie Nelson several times.
Oh my gosh.
We've performed with Sheryl Crow. Like, we've done these. We've done some just incredible. We've been on stage with some incredible people, and that experience in particular was. I mean, I have only fond memories of that. It was very enjoyable. It was fun to get together and practice with Bob Dylan, and just get a little glimpse into how he was working and how everyone had kind of warned us that he would do this or that, and he did none of that, none of the things that we were warned about.
What did they warn you about?
Which is great.
Oh, that's so funny.
Well, they said he would, I guess they prepared.
Right.
Like an ashtray with cigarettes and stuff. Like there were all these preparations for him, and he didn't do anything that anybody expected him to do. And I think it's wonderful.
What did he do? How did he surprise you? Was he just completely, like, welcoming and easy to work with?
He was cool. He wasn't, you know, he had a serious face, I'll say that. I don't want to sell him out. He was wearing a beanie and a wig, and that was I thought cool as hell, but it was also, it was nothing I expected. I was like, yeah, all of a sudden Bob Dylan has straight hair and a beanie with tuxedo pants. I thought it was just like, oh man.
Wait,
I just loved it.
Why was he doing that?
Anyways,
was he trying to be, like, incognito?
Maybe. I mean, it was there in Los Angeles. It was definitely warmer than. It was not beanie weather.
Not beanie.
Sure. But
I love that.
But you know, he was cool to us, and he's continued to be friendly to us and human, you know. But he's so big, you know. His work spans so much time and space, and. It's hard to the work is just not him, you know, like the work is that big, but there's still a human there, you know, there's still a human doing it. And I think that's important to remember when we all get together and treat people as people instead of treating them as their work, you know, like they're not their, they aren't necessarily their work. I don't know.
It's not only daunting to have that near you, but also you feel like it's this vault of information that you could potentially like tap into being around somebody like that. But did you, did you ask him anything or were you just there pretty much to learn through experiencing it all and like just observing?
Totally. In those scenarios, there's always somebody, you know, with that many people around, a legend like Bob Dylan, I feel like there's always somebody that's going to be eager to talk to him, you know, and good for them, you know. And I just, I try to really just be natural and wait for those moments to talk to somebody to come in a good way and not a forceful way with that person. And we talked about keys to what we were performing, like would A be better than G? I don't remember if those were the keys we were talking about, but and maybe how to end it and stuff. And he was open to those conversations. He didn't shut anybody down or treat anybody less than human. So, but yeah, I would definitely in the beginning just observe and just, I try to look at it like this. Like, I remember growing up being around my dad and the guys that he worked with, like, or being around carpenters that were local to where we live. And there would be somebody that's one of the old figures that we would see in breakfast or lunch at the at the local dive. And you just treat them like one of the elders, you know. It's just one of the elders that does a job. Bob Dylan's just, you know, he's a carpenter. He's a builder of songs. He's a performer. He does it very well. He's done it a long time. And just that's that. If it's appropriate for us to talk, we will. If not, I can respect him and admire him from afar. And that's really that. He's an elder. He's an elder that we all in the art and the, you know, writing and music business, we all look up to. And you have to be educated on him for sure, because he's that, everybody knows he's that damn great. But I would say that if someone was, I mean, I have to go, I've never said that I would want to do something with Mike Patton, and I've always overlooked it, but I got to say he's the single most influential on my perform, you know, my performing self. Not artist and performing self. It doesn't even really have to do with songwriting. It doesn't even really have to do that. It has to do with presence, stage presence and performing, and creating. That's because I could create visually in line with how he creates musically or sonically. But if there was ever a reason that made sense or was natural, man, that would be incredible. That would be quite an education.
It would be so interesting, especially looking back at, like, you know, I think sometimes when you do make the music that you make, especially with something as the signifier like a banjo, you do tend to be put into this box of there is no other music you can ever be interested in. Folk music is it. That's all. You know, you talked about like Van Halen and Ozzy, and I don't know. I feel like that it makes sense that you would be kind of attuned with somebody like Mike Patton, because I also feel like, even again, I think we spoke about right at the beginning of the conversation about, you know, that song, Tell the Truth. And even in that, there's kind of like spoken word.
He would, Mike Patton, I mean, that the spoken word stuff that he put in, like in the King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, and that Flight of Icarus piece.
Yes.
I mean, it's, yeah, like where that stuff moved me, man. It was like big for me.
I love that. And I think that's, you know, you can play. And again, we were talking about curiosity, you know, if you are really cultivating this lifetime of performing and producing art, whether it's visual or audio, you know, you have to make sure that you're stretching. So I hope that the next time we chat, it's about a collaboration between Avid Brothers and Mike
Let's
Patton.
Make it.
He's actually such a sweetheart. He's such a sweetheart. He never does any press, and because he's scary to talk to, apparently. I didn't know that going in. Yeah. I was just like, he's just this guy that I'm interested in talking to, and he's this kind of god, and his voice is something, you know.
Incredible.
Is there anything that you think musicians who are just starting out now? Because again, you come from a very different background and you've had a very different career trajectory to a lot of artists as well, and especially with the genre that you're in. So do you think there's anything that musicians who are starting out now, what do you think they should know? Or what do you wish you knew when you first started?
Well, I didn't know when I started, even though we did this, that those of us, the friends of mine that would break off and start to probably look like they were less successful, I didn't realize that the ones that would work more and do more were just the ones that worked more and did more.
Right,
and it was
right.
As simple as go play wherever you can play. You know, so many people would ask, or they would pine over, where should I live? If I'm going to, should I move to Nashville, or should I move to LA, or where am I going to, what am I going to do? And every time you're asking, what am I going to do? You're just missing a chance to go do what you're talking about doing. And luckily we had some sort of innate ability or just pre-programmed way of going, let's go play here. Let's go play there. Let's go play here. Let's go play there. Then there and then there. And it fed upon itself. And once the fire of that started, it wasn't a fire of people coming to shows, but it was our fire to go play. We didn't stop discriminating on where we played. When fans would say, oh, I don't like that place. There's too many fraternity guys there. We'd go, what are you talking about?
Right.
If they fill the place up, then that's great. We're not discriminating against who comes to our show. You know, like, come on. We don't have that kind of leverage, guys.
Mm.
And it just was nonsense. It was nonsense to say that there was a certain type of person. So we played everywhere and we did everything we could and played for fraternity guys. We played for country guys. We played for tattoo parlors. We played at churches. We played at coffee shops, bars, everywhere. And we loved playing for all those people. And now we have many, all types of people that come. But the point that I'm making is, how often do we get the kind of question, like, what do I do if I want to be a songwriter? Well, write songs.
Right.
What do I want to do if I want to be a performer? Go perform. Nobody's stopping you from that. Nobody. Only yourself. It's so true. And that means something different for everybody. But there's somewhere to go play all the time. And there's songs to be written. They can be rewritten. It's fine.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already. Thank you again for listening to this week's episode. Here's a little reminder that StubHub is the best place to score the tickets you need whenever you need them. Backed by their 100% fan protect guarantee, StubHub has the seats you want at the price you want to pay. And they're never sold out, so you can score tickets up to the last minute. Head to cosradio.lv/StubHub. That's cosradio.lv/StubHub. StubHub, and then enjoy the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.